In the old days, we saw it in like military, or you had to do like 500 squats, or you had to run 100 miles. And, you know, it was a pretty profound amount of damage to your legs. But now what we're finding is like, it only takes 10 to 20 minutes of vigorous like push-ups, pull-ups, dips, eccentric exercise in the arms to like blow them. And so we're seeing rhabdo after like 30 minutes of like really intense arm exercises. So, you know, that was something that we didn't know. We also, at this point now, are seeing it in women. We used to think that women wouldn't get it.
Welcome to the First Beat Sports Podcast, where we talk with coaches and sports scientists to explore the latest in how performance monitoring is making a difference in the NCAA and pro sports alike. We're going to connect you with practical advice from the best in the business to help you take your athletes to the next level. Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler is a podiatric physician and an associate professor of exercise and sports science at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. Dr. Hugh Butler is a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine and specializes in both sports medicine and exercise physiology. Her expertise is in exercise-associated hyponatremia and in endocrine regulation of water and sodium balance. Her scientific work has been highlighted on radio shows, including National Public Radio's Science Friday, and in newspapers such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, and the reality television show Adam Ruins Everything.
Hello and welcome to the First Beat Sports Podcast. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler, who is currently the Associate Professor of Exercise and Sports Science at Wayne State University. Tammy, great to have you here today and appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to talk sports.
All right. Could you kind of give us a quick rundown of your path to Wayne State?
Well, you know, so I'm going to go use a sports analogy here too. Sometimes like, you know, you have a play that's like all designed and it doesn't go right, but you still get the desired outcome. So that was kind of like my path to Wayne State, where actually I'm a podiatrist by trade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, like nobody knows that about me. They're like, really? And I was too stupid. I didn't get good grades to get into medical school. I'm like, well, I can be a podiatrist because my feet hurt. I can help me. So I started running marathons and they're like, you know, you need to like give back. You need to work in the medical tent. I'm like, fine. And so I was working in the medical tent of a marathon and these runners actually collapsed. And they were dying from something that we never heard of before. And it was called hyponatremia, which we'll go into. And that like started, like, these were my family. These were my people. So I actually left my practice and I moved to South Africa to study with a guy who first discovered hyponatremia. And so I got my PhD in South Africa and I finished. I'm like, well, what now? What am I going to do? I'm like, I really like science. And so, you know, I ended up actually, you know, going into a scientific career and ended up in Detroit, Michigan, a place where I also didn't think I'd end up, but I love it here. I just like the raw edges and people and the grind. So, you know, that's how I ended up at Wayne State. It's a research one, like high research intensive university, which I like. But interestingly enough, it's a Division II sports school, which is unlike University of Michigan and Michigan State. So, you know, in this really weird roundabout like way where my path was not linear, I ended up here. So my students, they're always like, oh my God, you know, I didn't get into PT school. What am I going to do? You know, sometimes your life takes a turn and you just have to like kind of go with it, not really knowing where you end up. So I don't know how linear your path turned.
I despise salespeople and I end up in sales, right? This is the irony of how it works. So even for me, I was always into strength training and hormones and that stuff. The endurance people, you guys are a different breed. Yeah, heart rate stuff's great. Go do your thing. And then sure enough, heart rate's my area now. So
yeah, go figure, right?
Yeah. You went to the source. You said, okay, I'm going to go to South Africa and learn from the person who really specializes in hyponatremia. So you went from South Africa and then back to Detroit.
I mean, I went from South Africa and then I was at Arizona State and I got a job at Oakland and then I ended up here. So, you know, this it still was non-linear, but I ended up in a place where I really, really, really like. That's okay. A few turns into here. Yeah. Happy where I'm at. And like I said, I started out as a runner and now I studied, you know, football. Like who would have thought that would have happened to you? So, but it's fun. Very different than running.
Yeah. So kind of hopping into things. So we always talk about internal, external load. Kind of what are your thoughts about what's your preference and how do you use internal or external load with your research?
Internal and external, I always think of internal load as like a deep dive into the engine. And external load is kind of like the performance of the body. Each has its benefits, you know, its pros and its cons. And so for football, we got first beat because of the strength and conditioning coaches. That's actually how we developed that relationship. And they were worried mostly about the big boys. I gravitated towards football because I study hydration and heat illness, as well as rhabdo. And so football, you know, naturally has all those things too. In the football data, they used a lot of external load measures. And what they found was, you know, the linemen, they had like the lowest external load, meaning they didn't move very much, but their recovery was really, really low. And people were like, well, they don't do anything. You know, why wouldn't they recover? And then Val, my PhD student, who's now at Notre Dame, you know, what she found was that internal load mechanisms, it was the big guys who actually worked the hardest and the longest. They didn't cover any very much distance, but, you know, they were working so much harder than the other players. And so again, external and the internal load complement each other. And why we like the internal load is, again, too, it's, for us, it's protective. And then to get to the recovery aspect as well, we like, that's why we chose and we like using internal load, not that over external load.
Yeah.
And again, too, it's mostly for me, it's a lot of it's a safety mechanism too.
Yeah. And I think that's usually where a lot of the football programs that we work with, they start out. They start out with the bigs. They start out with the hogs, the O-line, the defensive line. Because if you look back towards the incidences that have happened related to the heat stroke and illness, and unfortunately some deaths, it's almost always been with that group. And so I think that's been a good starting point. But like you mentioned, yeah, I see the same data. Offensive line almost always has highest internal load or the highest workload there, just because they really can't take a play off compared to some other positions that might be able to see what's happening and know that the play is over.
Absolutely. And the benefit too is like, so there's 100 guys out on the football field. They have all got pads and like helmets, and it's really hard to tell when somebody's in trouble. And so, you know, now we can actually see the monitors. And if we see some guys in trouble and they're not recovering, we pull them out. And I think it's really helped us make us feel a lot better in terms of protecting our big guys. And we still do that.
I wanted to touch on one thing you mentioned. So rhabdo, it's happened, you know, a few times here and there, you see at some programs. Is there any excuse for it? Because it seems when it happens, there's kind of the debate between some people are behind the coach and saying, oh, it was the player's fault. They came in bad shape. Or is that coach who was running the session, are they responsible for what happened?
So usually it's too much too soon.
Okay.
There's an op-ed, I think it was by Randy Eichner. It's like, usually the coach is to blame, because again, too, you know, what's different about an athlete is they won't stop, particularly if the coach is like, you know, you're weak, you know, you got to toughen up, and they keep going. So the athletes really don't have that much of an out if there's no, you know, that much of a safety net. And so again, too, like the coach driving it and not allowing them, I think that that's a larger part than the athlete coming in not conditioned. Mm-hmm. Rhabdo is evolving. We're seeing clusters of it in a lot of different sports. So in the old days, like we saw it in like military, or you had to do like 500 squats, or you had to run 100 miles. And, it, you know, it was a pretty profound amount of damage to your legs. But now what we're finding is like it only takes 10 to 20 minutes of vigorous like push-ups, pull-ups, dips, eccentric exercise in the arms to like blow them. And so we're seeing rhabdo after like 30 minutes of like really intense arm exercises. So, you know, that was something that we didn't know. We also, at this point now, are seeing it in women. We used to think that women wouldn't get it. And then we had a cluster in swimmers. What was interesting is there something in the diet that actually will precipitate the muscles to become a little bit more fragile? Because one of the studies we did there, they were actually taking a protein shake. And so if you have high protein in your diet, it makes your blood and urine a little bit more acidic. And so when your blood and urine is a little bit more acidic, it actually then will make you more susceptible to actually forming like kidney gas and crystals.
Oh, wow.
Back to your question. I think the coach is a dominant force because the coach dictates what these kids do. So I think that's a big factor. Mm-hmm. But I think now too, you know, we're seeing a lot more of it, and there might be something else that might be contributing, but we actually don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense. Too much too soon, but yep. We've touched a little bit on it when we're talking about overhydration. So interesting topic. People aren't so aware of it. What are some of the dangers of overhydration, and kind of what should athletes be aware of when it comes to this?
Well, you know, it's so funny because everybody hears about the dangers of dehydration. Oh, don't get dehydration. You're going to like get tired. You're going to have heat stroke. You're going to have muscle cramps. So you don't hear a lot about what happens when you drink too much. If you drink too much, it makes all of the cells in your body swell. And the two places where that's really problematic is one in the brain and the other is in your lungs. So if you drink too much, your brain can probably only swell about 5 to 8% where it runs out of space against your skull. And it pushes your brainstem out the hole in the back. And that's how people die. People die from drinking too much water. And that's exactly what happens. You get fluid building up in your lungs and they get pulmonary edema as well. They say, oh, you know, you can never drink too much. You can definitely drink too much. And an athlete, what happens is, you know, they're so competitive and they will do anything for an edge. Even if their body says, you know, I'm not thirsty, they will continue to do it. So they run into problems. Mm-hmm. That's the big thing. Again, too, it goes into like, yeah, then antidiuretic hormones. So you can't pee it out. Usually if we sit here and we're talking and we drink too much, we're like, you know, I got to take a bathroom break. You have to pee it out. But when you exercise, your body wants to hold on to that water because you're sweating. And so you can't lose it as well when you're exercising as you can when you're resting. So it's those two things in combination. But you can die. And the thing is, healthy, young, active people can die very quickly. The alarm is like, it's completely preventable. It's just people just know have to know not to drink that much. Case in point, too, you know, there's two high school football players. They were having cramps during August football camp and their coaches and their doctors told them, you know, you just got to drink a lot of like water and electrolyte. You have to drink a lot of water. So they did. And they started foaming at the mouth and like they died before they got to the hospital.
Oh, dear.
It's just misinformation that's out there that water will never kill you or any type of drink. If you drink too much, it will kill you. So, you know, moderation is the key.
No, that makes sense, the moderation. The episode that you did, so in my view, you're kind of a celebrity. You know, you were on this Adam Ruins Everything episode. The title was Why You Don't Need 8 Glasses of Water a Day, over 1.5 million views on YouTube. So this completely opened my eyes because I was under the impression I'm guilty back in my personal training bodybuilding days. You know, I'd walk around with that gallon of water with, you know, other guys at the gym, make sure we had a gallon in us a day and blah, blah, blah. But it seemed pretty simple from that episode is basically what? Drink when you're thirsty, right?
Right. You know, so evolution is just amazing. If you think that we needed to like water bottles to ring or like be reminded to drink, then none of the animals would be alive. Mm-hmm. These nerve sensors and sensors are actually in our brain and it keeps us from actually, you know, having too little water and then actually having too much water. So if you listen to drink when you're thirsty, that's innate in your DNA. But what we're going up against is marketing. Mm-hmm. So even like bottled water and sports drinks companies, they're like billion-dollar industries, something that you can get out of a tap. But again, too, you know, we're always told, oh, people are like, well, what about oxygenated water or like vitamin water or like alkaline water? And so it's like, it's all water, you know, and the same thing. They're just trying to sell you something. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where the misinformation came from. It came from the marketing to so that you can buy it, but you don't need it. And what's fantastic about Adam Ruins Everything is like, you know, they used humor to tell like the story. That humor telling the basic story, actually it sells. So, you know, it's almost like taking marketing on its back by trying to sell like human physiology. You know, I'm a one-shot wonder and I was very grateful that they actually found some of the papers. Like nobody understands the paper. Someone's going to point out how stupid it is to keep drinking that much. You're like, oh, I never thought about it like that.
Yeah. What I liked about the episode was every time you guys were mentioning something, you listed the study on there, where it came from. So, you know, today it's just, you know, everybody's a Google doctor, this and that. Well, I'm saying this because it was on this published study from PubMed. So that gave a lot of credibility to it. And I thought this was interesting that, and I wanted to ask, did you actually get any backlash from that episode? Because you guys straight called out the big dogs of the hydration world, so to speak.
Absolutely. You know, there's always a backlash and like, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. Everybody knows water. Some of the big problems is like there's so many different competing definitions of dehydration. So again, too, yeah, a lot of experts also are funded by industry and sponsored by industry. So there was a huge backlash and we still get that. Like, oh, no, dehydrate. So we still have like one step forward, two steps back. Again, too, because the science is fighting industry and the industry can actually, you know, tell you something and not have to get it through any type of regulatory body. Mm-hmm. But for us as scientists, which nobody understands, it's like, you know, we have to go through all these hoops and just try to get information out there. It's still not embraced. You will still see articles every day. Oh, you know, you don't need 8 glasses of water. Oh, yes, you do. So what we try to do is then provide you the evidence and let you make your own decision. And that's like the best that we could do. It's like, oh, that totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of how did this all come about? How did they find you for the show?
We published a big consensus, you know, we got a bunch of experts together. We published a statement. And so, you know, from all the scientific work that I did, they had reached out and go like, hey, that's kind of interesting. You know, can you answer some questions? And so then they wrote this script you know, they asked a lot of, you know, they did a lot of research on it and they made it like so funny. Mm-hmm. And they're like, hey, you want to come on? I'm like, yeah, you know, like, and so, I mean, that's how they found me through my research.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not like you have to go out and like market yourself. You know, you just, to me, it's like, just do good work.
So that was nice to see a benefits from publish some quality research, actually come on an episode of a TV show and help, you know, spread the word.
It was amazing to me, like of all the papers I've written and of all the, like the reads, you know, they track that. Nothing's ever hit as much information as that one episode. It's been amazing for us who've been fighting about the dangers of overhydration for a really long time. I mean, every death that I see hurts my heart because it's preventable.
Yeah.
And I feel personally that I didn't get the message across. So mm-hmm. Anyway, here we are. But again, too, deaths have been less. So, you know, knock on wood, we've been doing okay. For like people like you who try to help spread the good word. Don't waste it. Don't waste the drop. People are like, well, you know, you can drink all that. Like, what's the problem? I go, well, you're going to pee it out. But in this era of global warming and water scarcity, why would you waste it?
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. And I know a lot of different places, about, you know, like Finland, for example, where our headquarters are at, they've done studies here where they compared the bottled water to the tap water. Tap water was much cleaner, much better quality. So you're literally just paying for no reason.
Absolutely. You know, they're now the leaching of the plastic bottles. And so, you know, they don't know where it comes from. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's amazing, like what people pay, that something that you get out of a tap.
Yep.
It's just really remarkable. So
that is wild. So for the listeners, just so you know, we will have a link to this episode of the Why You Don't Need 8 Glasses of Water. If you want, you can just go to YouTube, type that in as well. But I will link it as well because it's a great episode. Everything here will make sense once you've seen that as well. Staying with hydration. So you as the hydration specialist, if I came to a Wayne State football game, what liquids am I going to see on the sideline?
Water.
Water.
Yeah, water. And there's maybe some, you know, those big tubs of Gatorade. But I mean, I think it's fantastic because they have a big tub of water and they have Gatorade and they allow the players to drink when they come over and drink it when they're thirsty. It's never like, you know, if they need it, they use it. And it's never like preached to like pound it. And so I think they've done it fantastic. I'm, you know, knock on wood, I'm always fearful of like, oh my God, hyponatremia, you know, rhabdo and heat stroke. And, you know, knock on wood, we've been okay. And so it's been a good strategy. Nobody carries around like gallon water buckets. And so that's all you find. But that's all you need.
Mm-hmm. How big a factor is cost? You said, you know, the tub of Gatorade and water. You know, if you had a bigger budget, would you get some type of special drink or is water Gatorade all you would get, even if you had an unlimited budget?
These are the three things that have to be available to athletes. Plain water, something with a little bit of electrolytes in it. So any type of sports drink, there's not one that's better than the other because it's all individual, like depends on how much you sweat and your sweat sodium content. And then for me, something with sugar in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so some people like, you know, blood sugar goes really, really low. You were looking for that Coke. So for us in like South Africa, you know, what do we like? Coke, you know, on races because it was like sweet and sugary and we got our like little fix. I don't think if we had an unlimited budget, that we would have anything that's more special in terms of hydration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can argue after like you probably need the proteins or something like that. Chocolate milk would be good for like muscle building as well as rehydration. So that might be a little bit more costly, but there's no magic elixir that's like high end that I'm like, oh, we have to get that.
Yeah.
Water, something with electrolyte, something with sugar. And then if you could have bonus some like a chocolate milk at the end.
That's actually very, very refreshing to hear. I remember, and this, you know, could have been 10, even 15 years ago, watching NFL games, seeing these players drink pickle juice during the game. Have we got past this madness, or are you still seeing some of this extreme stuff out there?
I'm going to counter that. I don't know what they're drinking because I think, like, you're right. Sometimes they have to have the sponsor's bottle, but you don't know what's in it. But I will argue if some of these athletes have a lot of sodium in their sweat and it's really hot outside, the pickle juice actually helps, keeps our circulation going. The salt actually will help expand the plasma volume. So again, to some athletes actually will need it. Do all of them need it? No. In the old days, when they found out that there was salt in sweat, there was a big push for athletes to take salt tablets.
Mm-hmm.
Salt is actually an emetic. It makes people vomit. So it used to be on the formularies for like poisoning. You give people a salt tablet. So when they started adding salt tablets, everyone was vomiting.
Oh.
So that went out of vogue. So have they eliminated the pickle juice? I think what has happened probably with most of the NFL, and if not also with the NBA, is we do sweat sodium testing, and that's big. So again, too, you want to replace what you lose. So there are some people who lose a lot of salt, particularly when it's hot. They will actually need some type of like sodium replacement if it's going to be for several hours in a hot environment. A small amount might need it. But for other people whose their sweat sodium concentration is really low, they would probably get sick on it. So I think there's been a movement to individualize replacement. And I think that's probably, you know, been a good thing.
Mm-hmm. If we touch a little bit on the lockdown and kind of research you did on the impact of the lockdown on performance of college athletes, what did you see or what have there any, been any adjustments to the training programs post-pandemic?
So we were not allowed to do any research on any human for 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, I kind of get it. We'll let them play sports, but we won't let you test them. Yeah. So, but I did have access. One of my PhD students is the swim coach. And so I'm like, okay, in a pool, you know, you don't have the variations in temperature and the water's the same. So we looked at like training volume before the pandemic and during the pandemic, and then we compared actually their swim times because, you know, it's fairly controlled environment. And what she found was that the pandemic, like it cut their training volume swim-wise in the pool in half. Mm-hmm. And the sprinters performed better with less training.
Okay.
Yeah, the mid-distance like performed the same, but the long distance, because they didn't have the volume, they performed worse. And there's a big debate of like, okay, if you're a sprinter and your event lasts 20 seconds or less, do you need to be swimming 5 kilometers in a pool every day? And so they showed that they didn't. And so they continue now, knowing that data, like the sprinters now don't have to do as much volume. That was probably the only team that we got to study indirectly. But again, too, the data that we collected completely impacted how we train them now. So, you know, we were able to cut the volume because it was unnecessary and they still performed better. So that was like our main pandemic study.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say blessing in disguise, but, you know, you wouldn't have probably found that if you didn't have those pandemic restrictions on there. So that was actually nice. You had a positive thing to come out of the 2 years where we were locked up.
Right. And I think, too, it also brings up a really good point is when you have like coaches on board with the research and you can show them that how the training is affecting the players, you know, you can make pretty good changes. So you have to have a really good relationship with the team, not only the sports coaches, you know, the strength coaches and the athletic training, so that everybody can sit down and say, oh, OK, now we have to pivot. We see in the middle of a season, athletes are losing lean mass. Mm-hmm. That should never happen. So to us, that's a red flag. That's like catabolism. You know, we need to like do something so that they can make it through the season. Those things were kind of implementing, but again, to the kind of individual. But the pandemic showed us like it was great for us because the coach was able to make the change. So you could make a difference if everybody kind of like buys in and is on board. Mm-hmm. Because I've met colleagues that collected data. Same thing is like, well, the coaches don't care. They've done it this way for a million years and they're not going to change. So
yeah, exactly. I've spoken to a lot of, you know, coaches, strength coaches, where, hey, I love the system. I want the system. But the problem is I don't want to collect data just to collect data.
Right.
Because it's only going to be me. And no matter what the suggestions are, coach is going to do things the way they've always been done. And
right. So it's baby steps.
Mm-hmm.
When I work with an older coach, it's going to take time to change the ways, but you can still make, hey, look, everybody's in red. And like that was yesterday and today, gee, they're dropping all their passes and like, you know, their throws are short. And you can like kind of put the bug in the ear, like maybe we don't need to do conditioning today because look at what they did yesterday. So,
<Yep.
laughs> yeah, I mean, so again, too, like, you know, it's a different approach that you can use. I'm old, but again, too, like, so there's an art to coaching, but then everything now is like the science. So, you know, I think if we can slowly try to trust each other, that will, you know, kind of be able to continue to merge their art with our science so that the players and the team can benefit.
I agree with the baby steps. I remember I met with one staff member and we were talking about, because the practices were way too long, training loads way too high. And yeah. He had a 4-year plan of, Year one, I'm going to cut practice down by 15 minutes. Year two, I'm going to get another 15 on it. By year three, I'm almost where I want. And I think by year four, I could get it down to the exact where I want it to be. But at first I said, that's ridiculous. But then when I thought about it, I was like, you know what? If you tried to tell coach that you can't go 230, you have to get down to 115, you've just completely disrupted what they've done for the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
But I really like the approach that, okay, here's my goal for year one, year two, and I hope by year three that we've made this progress and we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, and it gets you always knowing that, you know, you have to adjust. And so for us marathon runners, we got a schedule ready to get, I got to do this day. And, but, you know, you learn, you have to listen to your body.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, too, I like the long-term type of plan, but you still have to adjust. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if you're going to get a pandemic in there. Like, you know, the whole team just got like strapped. And that's the beauty that I think we all live in is like, you know, how do we make it better? And how do we, you know, we continue to evolve. I think when we try to stick with the plan, and that actually goes back to hydration, it's the people who start with a plan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to drink this much every hour and like, for, you know, like hell or high water. When you override your body and you want to stick to your plan, I think sometimes that's for me, that's when things go wrong.
Mm-hmm. This year, you've just announced a few weeks ago a new head football coach at Wayne State University, Coach Wheatley, Tyrone Wheatley. So have you met him and have you been able to talk about possibly, you know, looking at first beat data?
We've met. I've seen him a couple of times. And so he came from the University of Michigan, obviously like a highly regarded running back, but he was a kinesiology major.
Okay.
So he graduated with kinesiology. So he's all about the science. And so he was really excited, you know, like, and I told him, I'm like, yeah, U of M, you know, use this. And so he asks questions and he's very engaged with like, well, you know, you tell me, like, if you see anything, you know, let me know. So I feel really confident that he will, you know, at least like listen.
Mm-hmm.
Or like if we show him something, I'm really happy with that. We haven't seen too much of him, but, it, you know, like into like any change, I think is good. Not Coach Winters, because Coach Winters was a fantastic guy and he built good men and everyone recognizes that. But I think, you know, now everybody's kind of looking forward to a change. And again, too, we've had a few months where everyone's kind of like in limbo. So again, too, like trying to work on like refocusing, you know, I think you have to gain trust both ways.
Mm-hmm.
That is still happening, but I think everyone's, you know, moving forward. So
yeah, that's nice. The kinesiology degree, you literally don't have to do a lot of the translating that would, you know, maybe with another head coach you would. And for sure, hopefully he respects that, you know, University of Michigan football is using first beat and has for many years. Hopefully that iterates with him.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's move over to first beat questions. And you mentioned that the reason you got first beat in the first place was the relationship with the strength and conditioning staff. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, this was an interesting story. Again, too, because I'm a heat and hydration and rhabdo lady, I wanted to work with football. And so when I first got here, it was the strength coaches that reached out because we didn't have any relationship with athletics. When I came here, they said, you can't work with athletics. I'm like, yeah, which is watch me. So they're like, hey, you know, you want to collaborate, we would like to get some sensors.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the strength coaches that actually looked at a bunch of different sensors and they liked first beat. A, it was cost effective. Was it you that came out?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So again, too, like you demoed it. And so that was started our relationship. I'm like, okay, you know, because I had a startup package. I'm like, okay, I'm going to buy these monitors and we're going to have like profiles that you can use. But we have to do research. And so that was the original agreement. So that's how we first got into football and started using first beat. And that was 2019. So Val Smith was, I'm like, here, Val, just figure it out. And she did. Like now it is what, year four that we've used it? Our relationship with strength and conditioning was forged then. You know, it's been really nice to work together and we've been really happy with the system. It's consistent. We always get consistent readings. We can get consistent readings like across the entire football field. In the beginning, you know, the coaches picked which athletes that would use them. And the athletes really were offended. They thought that they were being targeted, that, oh my God, you're going to watch me, that you think I'm lazy. So they didn't want to wear them. But when they started wearing them and then, you know, oh, you know, they love the calories. Oh, how many calories they burn. And then they started to really enjoy the learning. They saw the value of like how hard they were working and like the recovery. So they embraced it. it was interesting. It went from like, no, you know, you targeted us, we don't want to wear it, to now they fight over who gets a monitor. So now like, oh, he's graduating, I get his monitor. So, you know, it's really nice to see that they have embraced the technology. They realize that it's protecting them. They like learning about like what's happening to the body and what's happening to the team. So that's also been really nice because we're at a university. I mean, you should take ownership of your body and what it does. Also, you know, it's been a nice bridge between strength and conditioning and the science. It's been a nice bridge with the athletes, and it's been a good to educate, even with the calories, like what should I eat? When should I eat? So it's brought up a lot of questions as well. So we've really been happy with it. So thank you for working with us. They like it now. You know, I'd love to see it during a game or a scrimmage, but they're like, yeah. So.
Yeah, the game data is great to have, but I understand why some aren't able to get it. Huge student buy-in. And I think that's great that initially there was some resistance, but then once they can find something to relate to, which, you know, for a lot of them, it was calories. That's really good just to start with something like this. And then you can start to talk to them about training load and recovery metrics and all those things.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I mean, the sort of for us now, looking forward means kind of like looking back and trying to compare and just trying to like, it's like watching a story unfold. We can't control anything, but we can see the story unfold and try to make sense of like what's happening this year versus what happened in the previous years.
Mm-hmm. When we look at the quick recovery test from First Beat, what kind of trends have you seen over the years with your team?
You know, we always studied the 2 weeks of August football camp because those are the hardest ones to study. But like I said, you know, we compared 2019 and then we didn't have a season 2020. So we came back 2021 and then this year, 2022. The trip was always, you know, was pretty much the same for all 3 years, but the recovery was so much higher for that 2019 year compared to the 2021 and 22. And it just made us think what was different about that. Scientifically wise, it's always a different group of guys. But again, too, it's 40 monitors that we just get a snapshot of everybody. And so the snapshot was they were better recovered. And how do we get them back there?
Yeah. But it's nice that you have that data actually. Okay, we had better recovery than what did you do practice wise? What did we do recovery wise? Things.
Right.
All those factors that you can maybe look back and see.
Right.
So the most useful First Beat like features and metrics, you know, we've spoken about quick recovery test. What are the other metrics you really focus on?
I like trim. Mm-hmm. I don't know that much about like acute and chronic workload or, you know, anaerobic and aerobic. It's as much of that. I mean, for me, my biggest thing is like the intensity over the duration. So that's like kind of like my go-to metric. And then that's like, I'm looking at the percentage of heart rate max.
Okay. What I mentioned to people is, you know, find the 2-3 metrics that matter to you and use those. Or if your job is you have to translate it to the head coach, then you better find the metric that resonates with him. Because when you export the data, you know, the people that love to do all sorts of data, yeah, do our data export. You've got tons of variables to work with. But with as far as the day-to-day operation of the system, find your 2, even max 3 metrics, focus on them, get really good at those. That's really what it is right there.
Right.
So yeah, actually there was a tweet. I noticed you're active on Twitter and you had a tweet that was looking at last year's data and its practices and the differences in trim values compared to this year. You also mentioned tendency for less vomiting. Can you just kind of tell me about this tweet and what you were seeing here?
Goes back to like, what are the metrics I use? So obviously one is trim. It's like, how hard was the session? And so the year prior, they like nail them really, really hard. And so again, too, the intensity was really high. But then like the next day, like nobody could do anything. So we had these really huge oscillations. And so then I also plotted the mean average heart rate of max. And so it gets you zone 2, the magical zone 2 is anywhere between like 60 to 7. And so I noticed last year when they really worked them hard, like the, you know, make them tough. The heart rate was really high. And then like the workout was like 40, like they had like nothing to give. And then it went back up to like really, really high, like a 70, 80 heart rate. And then it went back down to like 50. There were these huge oscillations in trim and these huge oscillations in heart rate intensity last year. So this year they took a more systematic approach of like technique. And what I found was, again, to the trim was slower, but their heart rate remained in that whatever golden like zone 2 between like 60 and 70. I don't know this much about zone 2 other than that primes you for performance because you're not working too low and you're not working too high. So again, too, on your easy days, you want to stay in this magical 60 to 70. So I found with these kids, this year, with the more systematic approach, they've stayed within this 60 to 70% zone. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, they're going to come in for DEXs. It's like, you know, are they going to have like a long-term foundational growth versus like the high, low, where they could did a lot and then they couldn't give it to him the next day. Last year when they trained really hard, you know, like the trash cans, everyone's like around the trash can and it was, you know, vomiting. It was awful. It's like a wind gate, you know? So like 30 minutes hard, the intensity is so hard, it just makes everybody vomit.
Oh dear.
Every day I get a new data point and it's just like watching a story. But again, to then trying to figure it out, like, you know, moving forward, will we have less injuries? Did we see more mass gains compared to last year? Because again, too, we can compare to last year, kind of see what worked for our guys and what doesn't. It's still a story that's unfolding, and I will continue to update those who are interested on Twitter.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Excellent. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. Tammy, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. This was a blast.
Hey, thank you for the conversation and for supporting us. We love First Beat and we hope to learn more so that we can become better with it. So we enjoy the partnership and the teamwork. So thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to many more years of getting some data with you. If you like this episode and want to hear more like it, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the First Beat Sports Podcast. For more information about us and our sports monitoring systems, give us a call at 435-363-9533. Or you can send us an email to sports@firstbeat.com. You can also visit us online at www.firstbeat.com. Thanks a lot for listening today, and don't forget to be with us on the next edition of the First Beat Sports Podcast.